Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, hello. Oh. Labyrinth.
Gentlemen, and welcome to the backyard. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and I want to welcome the callers in on calling in on the telephone and those listening online and those who may come by later on to check in the backyard to see what we're up to. Well, as usual, this evening I am very excited because I'm in the enlightening period still. Just learning all these wonderful facts about my culture that I never even had a clue about before. And if you're on my list, you will see that this evening we are celebrating Mr. Francis Barber. And he was considered one of the first immigrants because we're talking about 1743 or 53 or in the 17-somethings. And I stumbled on this story courtesy of Dr. Joy Lumsden, as usual, because Dr. Lumsden really come up with some unique information that is out there, but, you know, not really concentrated in one place. And, of course, not well known to the Jamaican diaspora, and especially me. So all of this is fresh and new, and I'm always excited when there are positive things to discover about what used to be even 100 years ago that can relate to so much of what is happening now. So it's my pleasure this evening. First of all, I want to thank everybody who's calling in or who's listening online or who may come by later. And I know that there must be some history lovers around because, you know, we're getting quite a few hits when we do something from way back when. So I want to encourage you to tell your friends and to, find a way to spread the word. So this evening, first I'm going to read from Dr. Lumsden's notes, and then I'm going to go into some other discoveries that I made just sort of surfing around and doing some more detailed research. This is from Dr. Lumsden's website, Francis Frank, in parenthesis, Barber, spelled B-A-R-B-E-R, was born possibly in 1735 or later in the early 1740s. in St. Mary, Jamaica. He was a slave belonging to, by 1750, to Richard Bathurst, Bathurst, of Orange River, St. Anne. Now, Orange River Estate in St. Anne. In 1750, Bathurst took Frank with him to the UK to join his son, who was also named Richard. So it's Richard Bathurst, and his son's name was the same. And he was a doctor in London and a close friend of Dr. Samuel Johnson, the writer and great lexicographer, which is actually the person who made the first English dictionary. So this is what is really exciting me, because there is a direct connection with this slave-born Frank, as he was called. His name was really Francis, spelled F-R-A-N-C-I-S. And he's registered to be born in Jamaica in around 1735. But what I'm going to be doing this evening is to talk about the possible link with this particular young man to the writing of the dictionary, because I think it's so cool. Okay, so once he got to London now, Frank was sent to a school at Barton in Yorkshire for about a year, then went to live in Dr. Johnson's household in 1752. When Bathurst Sr. died in 1754, in his will, he gave Frank Barber his freedom and £12 sterling. We're talking about 1753-54, so that might have been a lot of money in those days. Okay, back to Dr. Johnson's notes. Apart from two brief episodes when he went off on his own, Frank Barber lived with Dr. Johnson until the great man's death in 1784. During that period, he was servant, companion, and surrogate son to Johnson, as one writer puts it. There was clearly a great relationship between the two men. Johnson pulled strings to get Frank out of the Navy after he ran away to sea, paid for his schooling at the Bishop Stratford Grammar School in the late 1760s, and took Frank's growing family into his home. Frank cared for Dr. Johnson in almost every way, as valet and secretary, and nursed him in his various illnesses, taking communion with him when he received it for the last time just before his death. When Johnson died in 1784, he left the bulk of his money and possessions to Frank Barber. This guaranteed him an income of £70 a year. But over the years, the Barbers had to sell most of the items Johnson had left them in order to make ends meet. Johnson's friends, especially Reynolds and Boswell, helped the Barbers also. They moved to Litchfield in 1786, as Johnson had advised, and set up home there. Later, in the mid-1790s, they moved to the nearby village of Burntwood, where they, listen to this, where they started a school. Francis Barber died in the Stafford Infirmary in 1801, and his wife, Elizabeth, who moved back to London with their surviving daughter, Anne, died in 1816. Their surviving son, Samuel, and their dates here of 1875 to 1828 on whose education they had spent time and money, became a minister in the primitive Methodist movement and was well known in the Stafford region, where direct descendants of Francis Barber still live. And that so far is the end of her documentation on Mr. Francis Barber. Now, if you are on my list, you will see on the headline, I said that I am going to point out the connection between this slave born in Jamaica, Mr. Barber, to the Academy of Arts in London. Well, you heard me mention Joshua Reynolds and Dr. Samuel Johnson. Joshua Reynolds is a renowned artist who, in those days, we're talking 17 something, was the first artist to be doing watercolors. And he happened to have done a portrait of Frank Barber. Now, because of his association with Dr. Samuel Johnson, is the reason why Sir Joshua Reynolds apparently did the watercolor portrait. So, and I am assuming, because this is a collected work of art that is perhaps is still hanging, I have to check on that, in the museum in London. But I just I said, what a story. Here is this young fella being taken to England when he was 15. He was only 15. There's not a lot of information about his parents. You know, we know he was born there in Jamaica. But incidentally, another document that I read about the Bathurst family, their children were born in Jamaica, too. One was registered in St. Andrew in 17 whatever, and he had his father's name, and they sent him to medical school in England. So when the father, the senior, took the 15-year-old slave, which he owned at the time, to England, his son was already there practicing medicine. But he must have favored this particular young man in some way, or saw some genius or something in him. Why, I'm sure he perhaps had, that wasn't the only slave he had. It didn't say whether he owned Frank's parents, there's no documentation. I haven't been able to find any on that. But now I'd like to take you, first of all, to what Wikipedia says about Francis Barber, B-A-R-B-E-R. And, you know, Wikipedia is really put together by people, and a lot of times there's not authentic verification. But this is similar to what I found in other parts, so I know it seems correct. It says here 1735 to 1801, and that Francis Barber was the Jamaican manservant of Samuel Johnson in London from 1752 until Johnson's death in 1784. Johnson made him his residual heir with £70 a year to be given him by trustees, expressing the wish that he move from London to Lichfield in Staffordshire, Johnson's native city. After Johnson's death in 1784, Barber did this, opening a draper's shop and marrying a local woman. Now, obviously, she was white. Barber was also left Johnson's books and papers, and a gold watch. In later years, he had acted as Johnson's assistant in revising his famous dictionary and other works. So there we got some documentation that Francis was, or Frank, as he was lovingly called, I suppose, was instrumental in helping Mr. Johnson put the dictionary together. And I have other documentation in details about that and the relationship between both Johnson and that man and his first owner and himself. And we're talking about, and that's why one writer that is writing about Mr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson, refers to Frank Barber as the first immigrant, because he was actually taken to London with documentation, I suppose, at the time, in 17-something, being born in Jamaica. Now, officially, there was no slavery in England ever, but Englishmen or people had slaves that were bought and traded and all of that all over the West Indies, as we know it. But when he went to England with his owner, I suppose he was considered a servant and not necessarily a slave. But officially, when his master died, in his will, he left him not only money, but gave him his freedom. So what I'm going to do now is to go to some other information that I found that we just sort of went on lightly from these two documents. But you remember where it mentioned that he went off to the Navy? Now, let me tell you a little bit now about, let me get my papers here, because this story took me all over the internet, and I was just really caught up in how, and some of my fans that listen regularly will know how much I'm always so intrigued at the words that the writers then, in the times ago, used to describe scenes, people, situations. You know, they wrote sometimes in Old English, I mean, using elaborate words and words that certainly wouldn't fit the bill right now. And it just goes to show how language changes and evolves with people. But let me fill you in now on some more juicy stuff that I found. Okay. What happened, apparently, once he got to London, let me start where this article started. Barber was born a slave on a sugar plantation in Jamaica belonging to the Bathurst family. At the age of 15, he was brought to England by his owner, Colonel Richard, Richard Bathurst, whose son, also called Richard, was a close friend of Johnson. He was sent to school in Yorkshire. And when Mr. Johnson's wife, Elizabeth Porter, died, Johnson, who was a writer, really fell in depression. He was really depressed. And the Boswells sent Barber to work with Mr. Johnson. That was the first connection, because apparently the son who studied in England and would be more or less the age of this writer, he was young at the time, but not as young as Baker. Baker was quite young when he got involved in all of this, even when he got his freedom. So he went to work for Mr. Johnson 2 weeks after his wife died. because, you know, the death of his wife really messed him up. And they said he was depressed. So their friends who had this young person that they thought would do a good job went to live with Mr. Johnson to, I suppose, cheer him up and work for him. While he was there, he got his freedom. He wasn't free at first. So he ran off. And the first thing he did, he went to work for a pharmacist in Cheapside, C-H-E-A-P-S-I-D-E, but kept in touch with Mr. Johnson. He later signed up as a sailor for the Navy until retrieved, perhaps against his wishes, by Mr. Johnson, returning to his service. Barbara's brief maritime career is known from James Boswell's Life of Johnson. So this Mr. James Boswell was a friend of Mr. Johnson and wrote about him. So I'm reading from Boswell's writing now. His Negro servant, Francis Barber, having left him and been some time at sea, not pressed at as has been supposed, but with his own consent, it appeared from a letter to John Wilkins, Esquire, from Mr. Smollett, that his master kindly interested himself in procuring his release from a state of life of which Johnson always expressed the most uttermost hate. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Johnson hated the Navy. And you'll know why later when I tell you some things that went on in the Navy in 17 whatever. So Mr. Johnson seemed to have been a very conscious man. You know, he was seen to be kind and moral. So this young man had helped him during the time he was the other man's slave and working as his servant. When he got his freedom, he went to work with a pharmacist. Then he ran off and joined the Navy. I mean, can you imagine, he was a free man at that time, joining the Navy. And the Navy at that time was protecting seamen in some parts of the world. So they needed people. He wasn't working on a slave ship. He was working on a ship, a British ship that was protecting fishermen. So, Mr. Boswell is writing now. He said, no man will be a sailor who has contrived enough to get himself into a jail. For being in a ship is being in a jail with the chance of being drowned. And at another time, a man in a jail has more room, better food, and better company. The letter was as follows. It was written on March 16th, 1759. Dear sir, I am again your petitioner in behalf of that great CHAM, Cham of Literature, Samuel Johnson. His black servant, whose name is Francis Baker, has been pressed on board, P-R-E-S-S-E-D, on board the Stag frigate. Captain Angel, and our lexicographer, is in great distress. He says the boy is a sickly lad, of a delicate frame and particularly subject to a malady in his throat, which renders him very unfit for His Majesty's service. You know what matter of animosity the said Johnson had against you, and I dare say you desired no other opportunity of resenting it than that of laying him under an obligation. He was humble enough to desire my assistance on this occasion, though he and I were never Carter cousins, C-A-T-E-R, cousins. And I gave him to understand that I would make application to my friend, Mr. Wilkins, who perhaps by his interest with Dr. Hay and Mr. Elliott might be able to procure the discharge of his Lackery, L-A-C-Q-U-E, Lackacy, L-A-C-Q-U-E-Y. It would be, sir, frivolous, oh, wow, to say more on that, on the subject, which I leave to your own consideration. But I cannot let slip this opportunity of declaring that I am, with the most invulnerable esteem and attachment, dear sir, your affectionate, obligated, humble servant. And the man signs it, whatever his name was. Mr. Wilkins, who upon all occasions has acted as a private gentleman with most polite libertaries, applied to his friend, Sir George Hay, then one of the Lord's Commissioners of the Admiralty, and Francis Barber was discharged, as he had been, as was told me, without any wish of his own. He found his old master in chamber in the inner temple and returned to his service. To make a long story short, they were pulling some strings. One writing a letter to another one, and another one writing a letter to another one, to get this Frank Barber out of His Majesty's service. So I suppose in those days, if you signed up, you were in. And because Mr. Johnson considered a ship a prison, he didn't want his friend, because he befriended him, to be in jail. So he pulled some strings to get him out of the Navy. And once that happened, Frank Barber went back in the service of Dr. Johnson. Now, later, Johnson put Barber, by then in his early 30s, in a school, presumably so that he could act as his assistant. And this is a quote from Boswell's Life of Mr. Johnson. His sincere regret for Francis Barber, his faithful Negro servant, made him so desirous of his future improvement that he now placed him at a school at Bishop Stratford in Hertfordshire. This humane attention does Johnson's heart much honor. Out of many letters which Mr. Barber received from his master, he has preserved three, which he kindly gave me and which I shall insert according to their dates. And one is to Mr. Francis Barber. Dear Francis, I have been very much out of order. I am glad to hear that you are well and design to come soon to see you. I would have you stay at Mrs. Clapp's for the present till I can determine what we shall do. Be a good boy. My compliments to Mrs. Clapp and to Mr. Fowler. I am yours affectionately, Sam Johnson. And that letter to Mr. Barber, Frank, the ex-slave, was dated May 28, 1768. So let me take a sidebar here, folks. Do you see how striking all of this thing is? Now, here is a young slave born in Jamaica, taken up to London by his master, given his freedom, then sent to this place. He gets his freedom. He runs away. He joins the Navy. The person who he was working for figure the Navy going to kill him. He's sickly. He's going to pull some strings to get him out. He gets him out, and then he sends him to school. Not only is he sending him to school and paying for it, this is a boarding school. I checked out the school. It was a boarding school at the time, and he was there for 5 years. This man, Mr. Johnson, paid for all his tuition. Now, I am thinking in my mind, if it's a school, I suppose there were other people there. I don't think there was a lot of black ex-slaves at that school. English people couldn't even afford that kind of money at that time. So you can just imagine in my mind all of this. I said, wow, this is so intriguing. And at this point, I would like to take a break and remind our listeners that you're listening to Backyard Labrish on Block Talk Radio. We're here each Thursday at 8 o'clock, where we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. And this evening, I'm highlighting a very little-known story about Frank, or Francis Frank Barber, who was born in Jamaica in 1752 and was taken to London and became a very important person in the lives of these two men who really just took care of him in such a special way, and what he contributed in some way to the whole world. Not just England, not just Jamaica, but as you will hear as the story evolves. So I hope if you are like me and you get all tingly when you learn about all these neat facts, if you're on the board, you need to just hit one on your telephone and let me know if I'm making sense, because sometimes I get so giddy and I'm always reading this information for the first time, because sometimes I have such a hard time just collecting it and copying it and then printing it out that it takes me forever. So I don't have time to read till I get on the air. So sometimes if I'm stumbling and mumbling, please forgive me. But, you know, you can always go check all of this out yourself, and I really encourage people to do it, because I stick to the facts as much as I can. But one of the purposes I find driving me is the fact of the matter of how much things have changed over the centuries, but how much things remain the same. Because, you know, no matter what period we're born in, we're all humans, we have certain emotions, we have certain, you know, characteristics. So there's always some thread of the past that you can relate to in other people. And I just see in the midst of all of these atrocities and horrors of enslaving people, you know, there were still people who were very humane and acted with use their conscience in interacting with other people, and I could see a lot of it here, because I don't think that his first owner knew that he couldn't treat him as a slave in once he got to England, you know, like they were beating them and all of that here. I don't think he could be doing that. He might have been able to do it secretly, but he seemed to have been a man of honor to some degree to even go take him there and send him to school, because I don't think he had a lot of people going to school at that time, even English people, because, you know, reading and being intellectual was more or less reserved for the aristocrats and the people who could afford it. So I find this very, very rather interesting. All right, so let me, I will see in a show of hands, and let me remind people listening online, I think you can see the number right there that you would call in, which is 718-766-4558. and just hit 1 on your telephone. That will indicate to me that you want to join me in the Labrish. And I didn't take the time this evening to remind you that when we get together in the backyard, we take a virtual trip to the island of Jamaica, where we would be if we were there in our favorite chairs under the mango tree, on the terrace, on the beach, in the hammock, wherever. But we just take this time to relax and chill, get in the no problem on mood, and listen to some stories. But it's always nice if I have interaction from my audience. And the next thing I'd like to ask you to do is visit our website, which is www.backyardlabrish.com. And we are in the process of upgrading our website. So I promise you that before the end of the month, we'll have a brand new website, which we hope will be more interactive, and we will get you involved in some way by telling me what you would like me to research or making some suggestions, or better yet, being my guest to share some of your stories about visiting the island or growing up on the island or having parents from the island or something. So please keep that in mind. So let's go back to this fascinating story about all these people. Okay, so let me just get back here now. The last thing I wrote was, you know, not only did Mr. Johnson send this young man to school, but he supported him while he was there. He wrote to him. He had other people taking care of him, this woman, Mrs. Clapp, who to give his compliments to. I don't know if that's where he lived or why that was mentioned, but, you know, you can just think anything. But it's one thing to send someone off someplace, but he must apparently have cared about his progress and what was going on. So I will go back to my notes. And it says Barber is his name, B-A-R-B-E-R, is often mentioned in James Boswell's Life of Johnson and other contemporary sources. And there are at least two versions of a portrait done by Dr. Johnson's house, which may be of him, Barber, they're talking about. While making his will, Johnson asked Sir John Hawkins, later his first biographer, what provision he should make for Barber. Sir John said that a nobleman would give £50 a year. Then I shall be none nobler, replied Johnson, and give him 70. Hawkins disapproved, and after Johnson's death, criticized the bounty as being ostentatious, and actually criticized him, Mr. Johnson, for favors to Negroes. So even within Johnson's group of friends, all of them did not think like him. Because here he is asking, you know, Johnson was a writer and a wordsmith, and he was more doing his letters and poetry and putting his dictionaries together. And he was also doing his biography. And here he is asking this man some advice, because he was apparently his financial advisor. And this man is saying, well, you know, a nobleman leaves someone like that £50. And then he said, oh, no, I want to do more. And after his death, this man is criticizing it. He didn't perhaps say it to his face that he shouldn't give it to him because of who he was. But, you know, Johnson did what he thought was best. Okay, so it was widely covered. I mean, all of this information that I'm reading to here that said was widely covered in the press. Barber's life in Stratford was unsettled, and he was apparently given to drinking. He died in Stafford on the 13th of January in 1801 due to an unsuccessful operation at the Royal Infirmary. And from being in the British Army as a nurse in my early days, I know that for Americans, it's not a familiar word, but hospitals were then called at that time infirmaries. He was survived by his son Samuel Barber, his daughter Anne, and his wife Elizabeth. His descendants still farm near Lynchfield, and it would really be interesting to find out if their descendants still living in that area. And I'm always so intrigued and searching, like Dr. Lumsden, for follow-up on some of this. So I'm hoping that, you know, before I move on to another life, somebody will fill in some of these gaps, either at our website, send us a note or something. Boy, that would be really cool. Okay, so let me go back to talking about the documentation I have here. It says Francis Barber's marriage to Elizabeth Ball is featured in a short silent animation called The Trouble with Francis. I tried to find that online because we know that he married an English woman and her name was Elizabeth Ball. But apparently that was something that was done long ago by a modern person, putting an animated thing together about that section of Mr. Barber's life. I'm sure him being the first immigrant and becoming a free black, there wasn't any women up there that he could marry beside a white one. So I'm just being funny. Folks, don't take me seriously. So I wanted, for the people who don't know, might not know about Samuel Johnson and his importance to the whole world and the part that I believe Mr. Barber must have played to help Mr. Johnson accomplish what he did, I'm going to fill you in a little bit about Mr. Johnson. On April 15, 1755, Samuel Johnson published his two-volume Dictionary of the English Language. It wasn't the first English dictionary. More than 20 had appeared over the preceding two centuries, but in many ways, it was the most remarkable. Robert Birchfield has observed, in the whole tradition of English language and literature, the only dictionary compiled by a writer of the first rank is that of Dr. Johnson. Unsuccessful as a schoolmaster in his hometown of Lichfield, Staffordshire, the few students he had were put off by his oddities of manner and uncouth gesticulations, most likely the effects of some syndrome that he had. Johnson moved to London in 1737 to make a living as an author and editor. After a decade spent writing for magazines and struggling with debt, he accepted an invitation from bookseller Robert Dooley to compile a definitive directory of the English language. Dobsley solicited the patronage of the Earl of Chesterfield and offered to publicized the dictionary in his various periodicals and agreed to pay Johnson the considerable sum of 1,500 guineas in installment. So we now know that Johnson was just a struggling writer when he was approached by this Mr. Dodsley, or D-O-D-S-L-E-Y, to write the dictionary. So, Mr. Johnson was very ambitious. In his plan of Dictionary of the English Language, published in 1747, Johnson announced his ambition to rationalize spelling, and he offered guidance and to preserve the purity and the meaning of our English language. So he had an objective, is my point. Not only did he have an objective, he made a plan. He had actually designed a plan of how he was going to go about writing this dictionary. So in my mind, I am thinking that it's one of the reasons why he sent Frank to school. He sent Frank to school for 5 years. I'm trying to connect the years that he got this assignment to do the dictionary and when Frank was, but there's so many dates here and they go really far back, and I'm just looking at this material now, but just to satisfy my own curiosity, I'm sure that I'll get around to it. So we now know that Mr. Johnson lost his wife, he's grieving, the original master send this young man to him, he take a liking to him, he gets him out of his dumps. The young man gets his freedom. I suppose he just wanted to wander a bit. He go work for the pharmacy. Then he ran off and he comes back to Mr. Johnson, goes off and he joins the Navy. And Mr. Johnson got him out because he don't like the Navy. Mr. Johnson thinks it's a prison and figure he's going to die or something because he's sickly. And if you have a chance, if you're listening online, you will see that I have a little video going. It's provided by Blog Talk Radio, but you'll see the painting that's done by Reynolds on the little video thing. So you'll see that he really looks frail. He doesn't look like a strong black man, is how I would describe him. I am even wondering if he was totally, if both his parents were slaves. You know, we know all sorts of things went on in those days between masters and slave women. So I don't know. He don't look true, totally African to me, but I'm not getting into that. That's for another show, or, you know, you can make your own deductions. And I'm encouraging you to go check some of this neat information out. Just type in any of those names to Mr. Google, and you'll get all sorts of information. Some is things that people wrote, like me and my sidebar, and some are documented information from way back when. So let's go on to this writer's now, what he's putting together about Mr. Johnson, and that's why I know that Frank really contributed a lot to having this man accomplish what he did during that period. So, as Henry Hitchens notes in his book, Defining the World, with time, Johnson's conservatism, the desire to fix the language, gave way to a radical awareness of language mutability. That means you could chop it up. But from the onset, the impulse to standardize and straighten English out was in competition with the belief that one should chronicle what's there and not just what one would like to see. So I'm getting the feeling that Mr. Johnson was really quite a thinker. You know, he would think things through. And that's why I thought that he knew he had this assignment, or he knew he was going to do something constructive. He didn't have any children, apparently. No children was noted. We just know he had a wife who died. And 2 weeks after the wife died, Frank came to him. So he now gets this assignment from this bookman to do this, and it's going to be supported by some big person, the Earl of Chesterfield. So he starts to put his thoughts together and do his thing. And I always wonder when I do these stories, you know, how people that didn't necessarily know that what they did was going to transcend generations, they did it because it was their passion and they threw themselves in it, you know, full-fledged. They just did it with all their passion and guts and whatever it took, they did it. So I'm always impressed about that and know that that's what it still takes now. If people has a passion and a drive to do something, I mean, you need to go for it because you don't know what you're leaving behind. Everybody leaves a legacy. The legacy is just for your family or for a friend or for one person, but, you know, that is how you leave a legacy. And I get so inspired when I read about people of purpose or that contribute, how they came to do it. Because people just sometimes look at whatever they did and they don't see where they came from before that passion materialized and became the giant that live on, is my point. So I know I'm getting off track here, but if you flow with me and you're a history lover and you like to connect the dots, I think you'll see where I'm going and where my mind takes me as I read all of this. So Mr. Johnson takes on this job to come up with a real dictionary because all the others were like fragmented and they were not as usable as was needed during that period. So this article goes on to say that one of the reasons it became so popular is because he would not only talk about the words, tell what it meant, but he would give examples of how to use the word. And he would sometimes interject humor in his poems. He would get poems that other people wrote and what he believed the word meant in that particular poem. He would include it in this book. Needless to say, it became huge, you know, a whole lot of pages, and was very expensive to print at the time. So even though he had all of this passion and this information, it was perhaps, if you look at it from another angle, not well thought through because he couldn't sell a lot of them because they were expensive to produce in the first place. Plus, he also did not get the support he expected because there's one place here where he wrote a letter to this Lord, whoever, Earl of Chesterfield, who had promised, you know, to help him, and he apparently never did. And Mr. Johnson just wrote him a letter and just told him how he felt about him, my lord. You know, I expected more because you promised to help. I know you left me high and dry. I can't hear from you. you people don't, and you can read the letter online. It is really quite lavish with words, is how I describe it, in his, without being disrespectful to the Lord, to the Earl of Chesterfield. He was just telling him, you know, get with the program. You're not doing what you said. You're falling down on the job. I just really think it's very funny. But he goes on to complete this huge, huge manuscript. It tells, I forgot how many thousand pages it had, and it was so heavy. It had to be done in two volumes, volume one and volume two. But it ended up as even today being one of the most important works because it was even before the Oxford Dictionary. So it was used not only in England, it was used as a basis for dictionaries in other languages, in French, in German, and also it was used here in the Americas, and there is a statement here on if you do the Dictionary of the English Language, you will see where it's mentioned that because it was so early in dictionaries, it's still being used as part of understanding the law. So he not only touched England and all over the world, but even here in America. The Universal and Critical Dictionary of the English Language. He defined, one writer defined Johnson's work, arguing that from the time of its publication, it has been far more than any other regarded as the standard for the language, notwithstanding the evolution of lexicography in America, I was saying Jamaica. The dictionary has also played its part in the law, especially in the United States. Legislatures are much occupied with ascertaining first meanings, with trying to secure the literal sense of their predecessors' legislation. Often it is a matter of historicalizing language to understand a law. You need to understand what its terminology meant to its original architects. As long as the American Constitution remains intact, Johnson's dictionary will have a role to play in American law. And remember now that Francis Frank Barber was sent to school for 5 years in order to help Mr. Johnson prepare that dictionary. So I feel very good about stating the fact that I think that the first Jamaican immigrant was instrumental in helping to assemble and publish that dictionary. And with that, as usual, I want you to help me celebrate all of this wonderful information that is brought to our attention through the courtesy of Dr. Joy Lumsden, who I want to thank. And I'm so blessed that I was able to meet her when I visited Jamaica last year. So with that, folks, I hope you have enjoyed my little tidbits and also, you know, finding out about this information, because the more things we can have to feel good about ourselves, to feel good about our culture, to know that our people contributed so much all over the world is the better off we're going to be and the whole world. Because, you know, we need more things that we can celebrate and feel good about, especially in the times when there is so much that can be the opposite, where we don't feel good about things. So I hope you have enjoyed this hour with me. It's already 9 o'clock, and boy, I don't know where the time goes. And I want to thank you again for being here, and to look forward to seeing you again next week when hopefully we'll come up with something spicy. So with that said, I'm going to bid you good night. Thank you again for coming by to the backyard to labrish with me and to ask you, like I always do, to make it a great week. Goodbye, and I hope to see you next week. Have a great one. Bye-bye.